You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast, and listeners, it is episode 298. I hope you all had a brilliant Thanksgiving, and this show is a special Ask the Experts show. We have brought together an absolutely brilliant panel who will be answering your questions and hopefully giving you some top tips as we head over the next few months. I will start by introducing them all. First of all, top FEI veterinarian, Emily Sandler-Burtness. Emily, your first podcast with us. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It is so good to have you with us. We're looking forward to getting your insight. And I would say we have lined up listeners for you three different time zones to record this show, which is quite the logistical experiment, and it has worked. So I am amazed by that. Because my second two guests are both over on the East Coast, I will start with five-star event rider Will Fawdry.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, Will. And finally, completing the brilliant trio, Tick Maynard. Tick, good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
I think our last show with you on, Tick, was a certain Valentine's special, actually, earlier on this year, which proved to be quite the hit. I think we'll be bringing it back again for part two in 2022.
Yeah, that was a good battle. Shane and I were on the same team for that, so that was nice.
I think you came out victorious as well, if memory serves me correctly. Okay, so how is this show going to work? Well, essentially, listeners, you guys have been sending in your questions across social media, and we are going to be putting them to each of our three experts, and hopefully they will have lots of good advice for you. So we will work our way around them. We're probably not going to get through them all because there is quite a lot. So if we don't get to your question, then I am really sorry. But I will start with one that has come up quite a lot. And Will, I'll come to you first with this one. How do you deal with nerves, particularly somebody has asked when you are just about to go in the ring? Is it something that you have ever sort of suffered with, worked on? And what are your top tips for dealing with it?
Well, first I would say nerves are good. You need to have, I've learned to enjoy the nerves. And yes, I've struggled with nerves throughout my career. I work very extensively with Abigail Lufkin, who's a sports psychologist based out on the West Coast. I actually had a chat with her yesterday. I work with her year round. One thing that has really helped me with my nerves is to acknowledge them and understand why they're there. And what are the nerves helping me to do, and what are the nerves hindering me from doing? And really, you know, are my nerves overtaking my ability when I get in the ring? Or when I get in the ring, did my nerves help me? And so I think it's really acknowledging your nerves and figuring out what areas they're driving and what areas they're limiting, and sit with them and figure out how you can better manage those nerves, whether it's you do meditation, or you listen to music, or my personal thing is I have my box that I have all my rider stuff in, and if I'm super nervous before I get on, whether it be for the dressage, the cross country, or the show, anything, one thing that I do if I'm really nervous, the type of nerves would be like if I'm nervous about not doing a good enough job, or if I'm nervous that the horse is going to be, this is the biggest thing the horse has ever seen, whatever the nerves are, I put those nerves in the box and I shut the box door and I'll leave those nerves at the stall and get on and do it. And I know that they're there and it's okay that they're there, but I've left them in the box so I can go do my job. Another thing, if my nerves somehow get out of the box and come back, I really try to make myself think in slow motion so that I can feel and see what it is that I'm trying to do. But the biggest advice I can say is acknowledge your nerves, know that they're there, try to figure out why they're there and what they're helping and hindering them. If you need to leave them at the stall, leave them at the stall. And if you need to take them with you, take them with you.
I think that is very, very good advice. And actually, sometimes we can be it is, we're almost nervous because we're nervous, and the nerves are frightening. But actually, you're right. If you can learn to enjoy them and kind of respect them and think that's why they're there, and learn to manage them in that respect rather than sort of just be overwhelmed by them, we can help channel them into making our performances better. So very, very good advice. Tick, anything from you? Sorry, Will, is there more on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I guess rarely I notice it in the moment, but it's easier to look back at times I've been nervous and notice these two different ways of being nervous. But also I see it in other people, which is that sometimes I'm nervous for what I might be a reason in my head. Like, it's a nervous because I want to win, or because I want to get a result, or I want to look good. And sometimes, you know, I've been nervous because I've been unprepared, I haven't been prepared enough, or a situation is actually maybe even a little dangerous. You know, sometimes in clinics, I'll have somebody say, you know, I'm nervous about doing this. This is what my goal is, and I'm nervous about it. And I'll be thinking, I'll be looking at the ability of that horse and the training of that horse, and I'll be thinking, like, yeah, you should be nervous. Like, you should probably be more nervous than you are. Like, that's a dangerous situation you're putting yourself in. So there's those two different kinds of nerves. And so the first step for me is realizing that and trying not to put myself in a situation that's that dangerous, and like trying to be prepared for every situation so I know that it's at least going to be as safe as I can make it. And then when I've got the other kind of nerves, the kind that is really just about the winning or the fine tuning or the trying to do the best I can on that particular day, what I do in that case is, and I've just started doing this for the past year and it's really helped me a lot, is every single second I re-ask myself, what does my horse need from me right now? What does my horse need from me right now? What does my horse need from me right now? And that takes me out of my own head thinking about the future or the past or the winning or the dressage score. And it really gets me thinking about what my horse needs from me. And usually if I can give my horse, you know, what they need, that's going to also end up having the effect of giving me a better dressage score or making me safer on cross country.
Excellent advice. I actually think that is all very, very good advice, not only in our riding and management, but also in life as well. We can put that to very good use. Okay, let's go on to the next question. And this is one, Emily, I'll come to you first, and I'm sure both Will and Tick will have something to say on it as well. But from your perspective, what is the most common injury you see in event horses, and can it be prevented? We all want to keep our horses happy, healthy, sound, fit and well. So what is the most common thing that you see, and what can we do to stop it?
I think the most common injuries I see are either, you know, hoof-related, hoof bruises, and soft tissue injuries. I think those are the, you know, sort of the top injuries I see in event horses. When you ask, can they be prevented? I think in a lot of ways they can be prevented, but we're not going to eliminate the risk. You know, in eventing, we're asking, we're sort of, these are the triathletes. So we're asking them to do not only three phases, but go over varying terrain. So I don't think every injury is going to be preventable, but I think, there's a lot we can do to reduce the incidence. And usually I start with a really good farrier. I always say it's nice to have a good veterinarian, but you must have a good farrier. And I think when it comes down to the hoof-related injuries, having an excellent farrier is number one. Trying to ride your horse on the best footing possible. But with that said, not always on the same footing. I think training on varied surfaces is very important, especially for event horses. And I think both of those play into preventing soft tissue injuries as well. Good footing, patient warm up and cool down, good footing and varied surfaces, I would say, are really key to preventing these common injuries.
Very good points. Will, from your perspective, obviously you will have no doubt come up against most things throughout your career. What would be your golden rules in that respect?
My golden rule is being proactive. I have a really good, I'd say have a good team of people starting, and I totally agree, no foot, no horse, really good farrier, but also a good farrier that works well with the veterinarians. You know, we do a lot of balance radiographs when the horses get shod. That's not always
realistic for everyone, but I think that is something you don't need to do it every time the horse gets shod, but if you can do it, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 times a year, anything you can do to be proactive. And then also, like, I went through a phase in my career where I had a bunch of horses have not the same injury, but a similar injury. And I had to really kind of look at my program, like, what am I doing? And to the point where that was, I was really happy with my vets. I was really happy with my farrier, but I kept having these weird, just weird injuries. And I ended up working with, I think her name is, her first name's Karen, but her last name is Davidson. Anyway, she used to work at Purina. She's a equine nutritionist. And I ended up changing a lot of my horse's nutrition. And I think that's another really important aspect from the proactive side of it, is have a good farrier, have a good vet, do all the things that you can do, but also what you put into your horse is just as important, and make sure you're in a really good feeding program. And if you have a horse that, you know, doesn't look like all your other horses, this one top line isn't as good, well, it could be something nutritional that you need to look at. And there's really good equine nutritionists that can work well with the vets, with the farriers. And again, it's the team aspect. I have a little kind of saying at my barn that, you know, it's the bus. Everybody's on the bus. Everybody does a little something different, but the bus is all going to the same destination. So we all have to work together and get along on the bus.
That's brilliant, actually. I love the bus analogy. And that actually ties in to another question that we had sent in that said, do we get too caught up on feed and supplements? How important is it? And my take from your answer there is it is hugely, hugely important. And the same as, you know, what we put in our own bodies, we're asking these athletes to do incredible things. And therefore, the fuel that they get is key. And everything you've just said there, Will, ties in massively with that.
Yeah, and I very much agree. Some people, you can get supplement happy, and then, you know, it's a little bit, it's not necessary. Like my horses, they get a bran mash on Wednesdays and Sundays, and, you know, they'll get electrolytes on those days, but they don't get them every day because, you know, and that was all, that's done with my barn manager and the equine nutritionist and my veterinarian. I'm not an equine nutritionist. I'm not a veterinarian. And so I really delegate those jobs to the people who are experts in those jobs. And I think that's another thing to really take is know your job and allow people to do their job.
That's a good point. And actually, there is so much help available from lots and lots of different feed companies and supplement companies that actually you can get advice that you need, and everybody can have access to that. Emily, from your perspective, I mean, I'm sure you are very much dealing with lots of different teams of people. You're on lots of buses, as Will's saying goes. And I guess from your perspective, that is something that you see a lot of and talk a lot about with your clients as well.
Yes, yes, for sure. We like to say it takes a village. So Will's got a bus, and I have a village for sure. Supplements, you know, for sure, you come across people who are feeding way too many supplements. I spend a lot of time talking people off the supplement bus a bit, and back to the equine nutritionist. Will stole my spot on that a little bit, but for sure, I mean, we work closely with an equine nutritionist, and I think it's one of the really important things. He brings up a really good point, that without balanced nutrition, you're going to be behind the eight ball all the time. And that said about supplements, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of generalized supplements for a whole barn necessarily, but when horses have specific issues, I think they're hugely important and can be a game changer for horses that have metabolic disease, horses that tie up, allergies, poor hoof quality. I mean, I think we are really looking for high quality supplements when you're dealing with these issues.
That's a good point as well. Take anything from you on that one?
I mean, I just kind of as a personal story, I just thought it was interesting as I went from being sort of a student myself to being a professional, as I started to pick up, you know, more clients and more show horses and more results, I had a few supplement companies approach me, and I assume they're, you know, they're making it for much cheaper than they're selling it, because they then were offering to give me free product in exchange for supporting their brand. And then before you knew it, I was kind of, you know, giving all these supplements for no other reason than I was getting them for free. And I think that might be part of the reason why, you know, then people look around and they're like, well, Tick's giving these supplements. And just like these, you know, just like Emily and Will have said, after a couple of years, I kind of was like, well, why am I doing this? Like, I don't need to be doing this just because I'm getting these supplements for free.
I think that's a good point of every horse is different. And also, you know, always come back to the why, you know, why are you doing it? And each horse needs different things, and you can build up to what they need and go from there. Okay, let's go on to something that I think is going to be pretty topical over the next few months, because horses have been out on their holidays and they've had a lovely break and they've, you know, been fat and happy and hairy in the field and all of those things. But people are starting to bring their horses back in. So one question that came in is, what is the best way to bring my horse back after his winter holiday? Tick, do you have any sort of hard and fast rules about the best way to bring your horses back in after a break?
I mean, I assume you're meaning back into work, you know, if they're going to be an event horse or something like that. And, you know, I always spend a week or sometimes more just working with the horse from the ground. I know that's not a common thing. A lot of people often will get on and start walking their horses, or they'll lunge their horses, but it's a particular thing that I like to do. It really gives me a chance to get to know my horses, again, how they think, how they move, you know, that they can look at me and really connect with me. So I'll do, you know, what some people might call groundwork or natural horsemanship. I might even do some clicker training. I might even be teaching a horse, you know, just kind of something for fun, like to, you know, step on a pedestal or lie down or something like that. And it's just kind of a fun way for me to get that horse moving and thinking a little bit. And then I'll ease them back into the walking and then the trotting and then the more traditional way of bringing a horse back into work.
And what are your favorite exercises that perhaps people might not necessarily know or do, but they think, actually, do you know what? I really like the idea of doing more with my horse on the ground, but I'm not really sure where to start outside of the obvious. What could you sort of recommend as a good place to start there?
You know, just start with something simple. Just start by seeing if you can do the things you're already doing, but in a more thoughtful way. So for example, instead of leading your horse into a stall or leading your horse into the arena or through the gate, which is such a, you know, it's something that we do every day, and it becomes almost thoughtless, like for you and for your horse, the way that you might drive a car. But maybe try backing your horse into their stall or backing your horse through the gate or into their paddock. When you lead your horse, you know, it's so thoughtless to lead on the left side. Like you can be texting or having a conversation at the same time, but try leading your horse from the right side of the horse. You know, all these little things that we do can start to affect the horse's awareness and attention on us.
Very good point. Will, anything from you on that one, bringing your horses back in?
A lot of it depends on what I'm bringing them, obviously, back in from. You know, if they've had a really good, like Mama's Magic Way and Fun, they had a, you know, they both ran the 5-star at Maryland. They each had bone scans, you know, 10 days after that, just so that we have a good kind of roadmap going forward into next year. They came out of the event soundness wise really good and really strong, so they're actually still on holiday in the field, so they'll start back, you know, and I'll because they're on holiday in the field and they're moving around and not coming back from anything, I'll start slowly, you know, do a bit of flat work for the first week, then I'll start to introduce flat work on a little bit of a hill if you have the luxury of having a little terrain, and just start to, you know, it's a little bit of it is common sense. I mean, if you haven't been in the gym for a month, you're not going to go and bench press 250. You're going to start smaller. So I think that's, you know, a good common sense thing. I try to have the horses at least in work for, you know, 3 weeks before I start to introduce jumping. Prior to that, by week two, I'll introduce some Cavaletti work at the trot and canter. Do quite a bit of that in the winter, and lots of long, slow, gradual lateral movement. Like if I'm in a big field, if you're stuck in an indoor, you know, don't feel like you have to leg yield across the indoor, or you don't have to leg yield for, you know, 200 yards across a field, but, you know, make yourself go from the railed to the quarter line, but use the entire arena for that. So make it go really slow and methodical. So you really start to warm the horses, not just their forward and back muscles, but their sideway muscles as well. And then obviously, okay, if I have a horse that's coming back from any sort of injury or thing that, you know, that's working really closely with your team of veterinarians and your panel of people to bring those horses back, you know, slowly and methodically.
And Emily, from your perspective, obviously, I'm sure there are certain things that you say, please do this because it will make everybody's life so much better in the long run. What is your sort of top tip?
I mean, I recommend to my clients to, if the horses have had a month off in the field or they've had 6 weeks off, to think about that as the same amount of time to come back. So if they've been out for a month, I recommend that you take a month to come back to full work. And I really like a lot of what Will said about doing it gradually. You don't need to do a leg yield all the way across the arena on the first day. You know, do it gradually, do everything gradually. And I think it really prevents injuries when you're coming back from that kind of a break. Even if the horse was not injured and it's just on winter vacation, you know, try to do everything gradually and give yourself as much time as the horse was off, basically.
That's nice to think about in the summer as well, particularly if you've got a younger horse or your horse has had a bit of time off because they've had a bit of a break or they're coming up through and they've learned something new and they go out in the field. Somebody told me something really nice the other day. They learn more out in the field while they're thinking about what they've just learned than what you've just taught them, because it's all sinking in and sort of solidifying in that respect. Okay, let's go on to the next question. This one actually came up quite a lot, and I imagine it's fairly difficult to answer over a podcast specifically. So talking generally around bitting advice, Tick, what would you recommend to somebody that is perhaps just not entirely happy with what bit is in their horse's mouth? Where do they start in making sure that they have got the right fit for them?
I mean, honestly, 9 times out of 10, I feel like it, in my experience, it's not the bit, it's the hands that are holding the bit. And, you know, occasionally I'll switch the bit, and my wife, Sinead, does that a little bit more than I do. And she's got a good feeling, you know, intuitively for what bit's going to work with what horse and what person. But most of the time, you know, and for myself as well, I'm thinking, how can I ride better, or how can I train this horse better? And I think for me to give advice, I mean, I'm definitely not an expert on bits, and to start to say what bits we could use is, I'm going to leave that one to Will.
Will, any words of wisdom on that one?
No, I mean, I'm pretty much all of my horses, you know, I always say that if you can't do your basic flat work in just a plain snaffle bridle, then I think you got to go back to training. A bit's not going to win the competition for you. So I think being very educated on what the bit actually does. I can't tell you the number of clinics that I've taught where somebody's come in and their horse was a little bit strong, so they were recommended to put a Kimberwick on. And I mean, that winds me up, because I think you have to be very educated about what you're putting in the horse's mouth. Again, going back to my bus analogy, one of my veterinarians, she solely does the dental work on the horses. And I've had really interesting conversations with her, you know, when she's looked at the horses and looked at the bars of their mouth and, you know, try to, you know, this horse has got a little bit of a bruise in the bars of his mouth or whatever. So I think being educated on what bit you're using in the mouth, but I think the biggest education and the biggest advice I can say is that a bit is not going to help you ride better. You have to, there's no gadget that all of a sudden is going to make everything go better. You have to train better, or, their bits can be used to help, but I don't think you can rely on a bit to do a job.
Very good advice. And I guess there are so many different types of bits that actually go to somebody you trust, go to your trainer, go and ask for some proper advice and get some proper help with what you're looking to do, because maybe it is a training thing. So many times you see people suggesting things, and I guess there are, you know, it is a huge selection of different options that you could try, but just because it worked for somebody else doesn't mean that that is the answer to your problems. So that is very, very good advice. Okay, next one is, somebody is a young and up and coming rider in the sport. What do they need to do to succeed? Will, from your perspective, what do you really like to see in people that want to make eventing and horses their job?
Start playing tennis? No, I'm kidding. pick up golf? No. You got to do it for the love of the horse and the love of the game. It's, you know, nothing will break your heart quicker than a horse. So, you know, and also nothing can break your heart quicker than a horse, but also nothing can put your, you know, take a piece of your heart like a horse can. And so for me anyway, and so I think the biggest advice I can say is that if you want to look at a profession in horses, whether it be eventing or a different discipline, do it for the love of the game, not for the love of competition, not for the love of the ribbons, not for the love of anything other than the love of the game and the love of the horse.
I think that's very good advice.
And it's a lot of work, and you gotta put the work in. You gotta, you know, back to the bidding conversation, you know, bit's not, you gotta do the work. You gotta slow down and put the time in the tack to feel what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, horses will take you to amazing places. And it's, weirdly enough for me, sometimes the places are just around my own farm when I've taught a horse something and we have a breakthrough moment. And it's the satisfaction I get from that. And do it for the love of the game.
I like that a lot. Resilience, they will build a lot of resilience as well. You definitely need that. Emily, how about from your perspective? Because there's obviously lots of different ways, and we're talking about the village and the bus, and there's loads of different ways of being involved in this brilliant journey. What about your advice to somebody that is keen to make a career in horses but might not want to go down the sort of the riding route as such?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many facets just from talking about Will's bus in my village. There's nutritionists and farriers and veterinarians and riders and therapists. And I mean, I think there's really a lot of options for me. You know, I grew up riding event horses as well. And for me, it was a sort of conscious decision. I was good, but not the best for sure in the riding piece of it. And so it was a very conscious decision for me when I pursued veterinary medicine. I still wanted to be involved with event horses for sure. And I, you know, do miss riding sometimes, but I also get a lot of satisfaction from being part of the bus, you know? So I think there are a lot of options. I think the first thing is to surround yourself again with good people, get experience in a lot of different aspects of it before you kind of see which direction you want to go.
Tick, anything from you to add on this one?
Yeah, I totally agree with those things. And I think to not only maybe surround yourself with those people, but to try, you know, to try jobs in those industries you might be considering, like whether it's a working student for the best person you can find, or you see if you can get a job as a vet tech for the best vet in your area, or you go an apprentice with a farrier, or you go an apprentice with a horse dentist, or you see if you can get a job, you know, for the summer selling saddles and learn about saddle fit, to actually go out for 6 months or a year and really work hard and surround yourself by that industry or that part of the industry and see if you like it, see if you can handle it.
And one of the things that's always amazing about our sport and our industry is that everybody is very, very supportive. And if you ask the questions, I'm sure some of the answers will be very forthcoming. Okay, last couple of questions. One that kind of goes back a little bit to the nerve question earlier on in the show. And Will, I'll ask you, somebody has sent in a question that says, feeling the pressure to do well with a horse that has done well before me. Any tips?
So I'll start by saying,
the word partnership. I've been very fortunate in my career. I have had horses that I got that had way more experience than me at the beginning of my career, and also, you know, more recently. I think that you have to take the time, if you get a horse that has been competitive and successful with somebody else, give yourself time to understand a partnership with it, with the horse. And then from that, you can't compare, and it's hard because we all do it. Well, they were successful and I'm not, or they were successful, so I have to be. And that is pressure that I'll leave in my box when I get on. It's fine to feel the pressure. It's fine to acknowledge the pressure, but I can't take that pressure with me when I get on the horse. So I have to leave that pressure. For me, I have to leave that pressure somewhere. I leave it on the shelf, or I leave it in my box, or I leave it in my car, or I leave it somewhere. And again, the biggest advice I can, and I'll go back to what I said earlier, the biggest advice I can say, whether it's nerves or pressure, acknowledge it. It's fine to have that. That's a human emotion. It's a human trait. Acknowledge it. Know that it's there. And that if it's nerves that are going to help you, take them with you. If it's pressure that's going to help you, take it with you. If it's pressure that is not going to help you, leave it at the barn.
Very solid. And I think it comes back into the no, like you shouldn't measure up to other people as well. You know, you do you. Essentially. Okay, last two questions, which I'm going to say to all of you. So the first one is, what are the three biggest management things that help keep event horses happy and healthy? Some of yours might overlap here, so don't worry. I'm not expecting you to think of different things. But to you, what are your top three? Emily, I'll come to you first.
I think my top three are nutrition, which we'll definitely touched on earlier, farrier care, and preventative medicine, you know, meaning your yearly vaccines, your dental care, your deworming, which I think is sometimes forgotten and not thought about, but deworming is super important, and especially through a managed program where you know what kind of parasites you're dealing with. So my big three are nutrition, farrier care, and preventative medicine.
Okay, Will?
The three things that I take forward is knowing my jobs. No, everybody knows their job. You gotta have, like, it takes a village, it takes a bus, whatever, but know your job and trust the people in their job. And if you don't have faith with that person in the job, find somebody else that can do that job. And second thing is, you know, the psychology of it. I work a lot with, you know, the psychology of, for myself, for the competitions, and also the psychology of the horse. The horse has to understand why we're asking them to run down the things that don't fall down. And, you know, I think when horses understand the job and they understand the sport, they have fun doing it. So knowing your job, the psychology, and then the proactive care.
I like that. Three very good suggestions. Tick, it's hard coming to you last, sorry, because the others have come up with some really good ones, but anything else from you that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I really agree with those things. I think for me, just to add on to that, a really important thing is the atmosphere in the barn and in the paddocks and the work environment for the horses and the people, something where you come out and you feel like the horses and the people and everything around you has a nice vibe to it, and that the horses aren't, you know, running in the fence, you know, in the paddocks or pacing the fence lines, and you don't have grumpy people in the barn, but you got a nice vibe in the workspace. And you know what Will said about a horse that understands their job, to me when a horse understands their job, that's going to be a relaxed, happy horse. The anxious, you know, the opposite of that is a horse that is anxious in their job, and you can see that in their ears or their mouth. And you can see that sometimes even in the ulcers that they get. You know, a lot of sport horses get ulcers from anxiety. So a relaxed, happy horse that understands their job is really important to me.
Okay, that is very good. One thing I was going to ask, and I've just lost the question because it ties in very nicely, Tick, with what you just said, was around people, horses that are aggressive. Are there horses that are aggressive in so much as when they're out in the field, how their sort of field position with horses that they might be turned out with, that translates into behaviors when they are then being ridden or being worked with on the ground? Or are there, generally speaking, other things at play?
I think horses have the capability to be aggressive for sure. You know, if you think about a wild band of horses and you think about, you know, a stallion, you know, meeting a stallion from a rival herd. I've actually seen a documentary where a stallion comes upon a rival herd and there's a foal that hasn't gotten up. And the stallion picks up that 2 hour old foal, and with his teeth, he shakes that foal to death. And so the capability, you know, there's a saying, within every wild horse, there's a tame horse, and within every tame horse, there's a wild horse. So while I acknowledge that can exist, I would say 99% of the time when somebody comes to me and says their horse is aggressive and I look closer, instead what I see is a horse that is defensive, or a horse that is fearful, or a horse that doesn't understand the situation, or is confused, or is anxious. So I think it's possible, but I think it's a very small percentage of the time.
Okay, very good. Look, team, thank you so much. It has been fascinating to be able to pick your brains. I mean, I have a list of questions as long as my arm. So listeners, I'm really, really sorry if I didn't get through yours, because we had so many sent in. And there are so many different things that we could ask each of you about. So hopefully we have given you a real insight into some of those topics, and you will have taken something from it. Tick, Will and Emily, thank you all so, so much. Really appreciate all of your time. And it has been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, we hope you've enjoyed it. We will do another Ask the Expert panel in 2022. For now, though, that is all we have got time for. We'll be back very soon with more on the USCA official podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the USCA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.